can start. I had to just to wait a bit before I could see that I've got my quorum. I can be able to proceed. Maybe first and foremost, I'm sure the committee members do have the proposed agenda before you. Welcoming everyone who's here, I just have to check apologies, because I've got only one apology, if I can just check with the Secretariat, in terms of those who will be able to join or not to join us. Okay. The only apology I've got is Honourable Member Mbuyane, and besides that, everyone else should be here, and who's not here should be actually the ones who will be joining us late. Can we then actually have a agenda for today's meeting considered by honourable members? We do actually have a session, formal consideration of SACUM UK trade agreement as one first subject. We do actually also, after tea, have a briefing on the implementation of the Competition Amendment Act. So if ever maybe we have any comments from honourable members, we can be able to actually proceed as proposed in the circulated agenda. Floor is yours, Hermans.
Thank you, Chair. I propose adoption of the agenda as tabled.
Okay, Mautsi.
Thank you, Chairperson. I second the proposal.
I hope there's no objection. If we can actually then be able to proceed, speaking to the two items on the agenda, I thought it would be quite important that we pick up on the first one, briefing on the formal consideration of the economic partnership agreement between SACUM UK. This agreement was tabled on Tuesday, 22nd October 2019, and referred to the Committee for Consideration and Report. So we would actually be speaking to the report as well. The purpose of this meeting is to consider the economic partnership agreement between SACUM UK for recommendation for approval, for ratification, and formally adopt a report on the committee recommendation. On his communication with the Speaker, the Minister implored that the Parliament approves the said agreement for ratification by the 31st October 2019. Failure to do so would mean South Africa's trade with UK would be conducted on the basis of a memorandum of understanding, which is formally exited the European Union. The MOU is neither legally binding nor enforceable. Therefore, an agreement would be preferable. The committee should note that it has been briefed by the DTI on the developments in respect to the agreement on the 11th September 2019. So I think that's what the first part of the discussion is about. On the second part of the adopted agenda by the committee, it's briefing on the implementation of the Competition Amendment Act. The Fifth Parliament adopted the Competition Amendment Bill and submitted it to the President for assent. On the 13th February 2019, the President assented to the bill, and the Competition Amendment Act number 18 of 2018 was signed into law. Subsequent, on the 12th of July 2019, the President published a notice on the Government Gazette which brought into force certain provision of the Competition Amendment Act. The purpose of this meeting is to receive a briefing from the Department on the provision that came into effect from the 12th of July and the implementation thereof. So I thought maybe let me just summarize those specific agenda items as we actually have them before us. And can I then actually invite Minister to actually introduce the team we have with you to the meeting and actually be able to then proceed with the presentation. Thank you, Minister. Floor is yours. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning to honourable members, to the officials of Parliament, to the guests who are present, and of course to the team from the department. Chairperson, for the first item on the agenda, I'm accompanied by Nikki Krier, who is the essentially the chief legal person that has been navigating our work on the economic partnership agreement, and the rest of the team we will be introducing when we come to the second item on the agenda. One or two members of that team are on their way, and that is on the competition issue. If I may then start by appreciating this opportunity to address the committee and to thank the committee for the patience you've shown in assisting us to navigate and to deal with the conclusion of economic partnership agreement. With your permission, Chair, I'm going to ask Nikki Krier to do the main presentation, to take committee members through the detail, but I'd like to make a few high-level remarks. And I'll start with the United Kingdom has been one of South Africa's longest and oldest trading partners, and it's a trading relationship that involves considerable exchange of goods and increasingly services. Over the last number of years, two decades or so, the legal basis of our trade relationship has been set through the agreements that South Africa has had with the European Union. The UK has been a member of the European Union and its predecessors for probably about four decades or so. A few years ago, the UK gave notice of its intention to withdraw from the European Union following a referendum that was conducted. And that meant we needed to reconsider the legal basis for our trade relationship. We had secured through the European Union preferential access to the entire European market. That meant that we would have duties that applied to South African goods that were lower than what is called the most favored nation formula. So if we were able to retain that set of benefits, we would ensure that irrespective of what happens to the UK-European Union relationship, South Africa would not be the loser. That was really what we needed to grapple with. The legal form of our relationship with Europe currently is an economic partnership agreement. The economic partnership agreement, among others, regulate the tariff arrangements between ourselves. We therefore proposed some years ago that we should enter into an economic partnership agreement with the United Kingdom to ensure that we were no worse off and preferably that we would be better off than we are currently. Those talks have been going on for a number of years, and they essentially grappled with what are the principles we're trying to establish. And South Africa entered into those talks together with a number of our neighbors, Botswana, Lesotho, Eswatini, and Namibia, as members of SACU, and Mozambique as a co-signatory of the Economic Partnership Agreement with the European Union. In those discussions, we sought at the very least to ensure that the United Kingdom granted South African goods and Southern African goods the same facilities that we currently enjoy. The talks initially progressed well, and then there were moments when there were significant difficulties that were encountered in the talks, and there were considerable delays. We reset the clock and put more urgency to it from July this year, and I had the opportunity to make a ministerial statement in the National Assembly on the 17th of September, where we provided details of an agreement that we had reached with the United Kingdom. And the basic principle of that agreement was to at least retain what we have in place currently affecting the United Kingdom. And that means if Britain stays in the European Union, there will be no change to our relationship. If Britain leaves the European Union with a proper withdrawal agreement, there would be no change to our relationship. If Britain leaves without a withdrawal agreement, there will be no change to our relationship. So we try to identify each of the scenarios and ensure that we have a legal regime in place that would mitigate and manage the effects of it. Honourable members are no doubt all very familiar with the detail, given that the National Assembly had a discussion on this on the 17th of September. Following the conclusion of an agreement, we took the agreement to Cabinet. The South African Cabinet endorsed the agreement, and in accordance with the procedures, we then waited for the signing ceremonies. And once we had all the countries had signed the agreement, we forwarded the agreement to the Speaker of the National Assembly for tabling in Parliament. Parliament is required to ratify the agreement. Once at least the South African Parliament and the UK Parliament have ratified the agreement, they become legally enforceable as between the UK and ourselves. Each of the other countries also have legal regimes in place. In some cases, they require ratification by parliaments. In other cases, they simply require formal approval by ministers, presumably with the backing of their cabinets. In our cases, I've indicated, parliament has to ratify. Now, until about a week ago, it was still unclear whether the UK would leave the European Union on the 31st of October, and we had made an arrangement that we would have an MOU in place should that happen before Parliament has ratified the agreement. First prize would be formal ratification, but we had a plan B in place should there be any delay. It has now become evident since yesterday that the UK will not leave, or is extremely unlikely to leave the European Union by the 31st of October. The European Union has agreed to an extension of up to the end of January for the United Kingdom to conclude an appropriate withdrawal agreement and have it ratified by its parliament, and in the case of Europe, that it would be ratified on the European side. So we've got a little bit more time than we otherwise would have had, which is not a bad problem to have. And we are now, today, we would want to have an opportunity with your support, Chairperson, to take the committee through the detail of what the agreement covers, and perhaps just to give a little bit of colour of some of the areas that were sticky points, and to indicate the future work program that will be that is embedded in the agreement, what they call the built-in agenda, to address some concerns that we have on how we can improve the agreement, but which was not part of the initial discussion. So I guess the overall message is that the agreement as it stands now passes constitutional muster, that we've dealt with, we've obtained the necessary legal opinions to ensure that it is an agreement that we are permitted to enter into, that the effect of the agreement would be to enable South African companies to continue to export their products to the United Kingdom, irrespective of what happens in the relationship between the UK and Europe. And it would protect South African jobs, and for that reason, it is something that we feel we would be urging Parliament to ratify. So, Chair, with those very, very brief remarks, I am happy, as soon as you are, to ask that Nikki then takes us through the detail of the agreement, and I will be available with her to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Minister, and then welcome to Chief Legal Officer. Maybe also at the same time, maybe acknowledge the DG and the officials from the department. So maybe we can say floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. And thank you, Minister, for giving the introduction. I think a lot of the issues in the first few slides, Minister has really already covered in the introduction. But just to go over it quickly again, in June 2016, the UK voted to leave the EU, Brexit, called Brexit. And in March 2017, they officially notified the EU of their intention to leave. That gave them a two-year period to negotiate a withdrawal agreement. And they were set to leave, in terms of this notification that was given in March, they were set to leave at the end of March 2019. As soon as the UK notified the EU of this intention to leave, we started engagements with the UK to ascertain what this will mean for our relationship with the UK and especially our trade with the UK, as they currently are part of the EU, and as ministers indicated, we have a trade agreement between South Africa and some other countries in the region and the European Union. They negotiated a withdrawal agreement that was agreed early in this year, in January, between the EU and the UK. And that withdrawal agreement provided, amongst others, that there would be a transitional period during which the trade agreements that the EU have in place with their various trading partners, that will stay in place for the UK until the end of 2020. But this withdrawal agreement on numerous occasions was rejected by the UK Parliament, not because of this specific provision, but because of a provision that's called the backstop. It deals really with the border between Ireland and Northern Ireland. This then necessitated the request from the UK to the EU to extend the period for the negotiation, so their period of exit, until the 31st of October 2019. Currently, as I'm sure you all know from the various news and media articles, there is a wide divide or deep divide in the UK about whether they should leave and if they leave, on what terms they should leave. So this is still something that we will have to see how that is going to play out in future. But as Minister indicated, we wanted to make sure that whatever the UK and the EU decide, we are sure that our trade relationship with the UK will not be interrupted, whatever the outcome may be of these decisions in the UK and the discussions with the EU. So in terms of the date of the 31st of October, so the date currently set for the UK to leave, the UK have negotiated some amendments to the agreement that was agreed with the EU on 17 October this year that dealt with the issue of contention. This new or amended withdrawal agreement was again submitted to the UK Parliament, and again the UK Parliament indicated that they're not ready now to consider that agreement. They wanted the UK government to put legislation in front of Parliament that will really domesticate, if you want to say, the withdrawal agreement. So they want to see the legislation that where, in which the withdrawal agreement is embedded, and then they will there will be further discussions. So this process is still ongoing in the UK, but since this withdrawal agreement was not agreed by the 19th of October, the UK were, in terms of domestic legislation in the UK, they had to ask for an extension, a further extension from the EU until the 31st of January 2020 to formally exit. That request has been made, and that request was agreed yesterday. So yesterday, the 27 EU countries agreed to the extension, and that extension, as I understand, has now been accepted also by the UK. So the UK will now only leave on the 31st of January 2020, except if a withdrawal agreement is agreed sooner. So earlier, if a withdrawal agreement is then agreed by the Parliament earlier, there is an opportunity in terms of the term set out for this extension for them to leave at the earlier date. But as I've indicated, if they leave with a withdrawal agreement, the agreement that we have in place with the European Union will stay in place also for the UK until the 31st of December 2020. So that is just a brief background. It's, the issues are still very uncertain. There's also some push by the Prime Minister of the UK for a referendum where some of these issues may come up again. So we will have to see in the next few months what happens there, and then we will have a clearer indication whether they are leaving the UK and when they are leaving and on what terms they will be leaving. But what we wanted to put in place is something that whatever whatever happens in the UK and the EU, we are sure that our trade, as I've indicated, will continue as it currently does. So in terms of our current trade relationship with the European Union, that also then still currently covers the United Kingdom, we've agreed the economic partnership agreement between the Southern African Development Community, EPA Group, and the EU in 2016. This agreement formally or provisionally entered into force on the 10th of October 2016, while some countries in the EU are still going through ratification, but this agreement is currently governing our trade. The SADC EPA group consists of South Africa with our partners in the Southern African Customs Union, Botswana, Eswatini, Lesotho and Namibia, and then of course also Mozambique that has joined these negotiations. Under the Economic Partnership Agreement with the EU, we have fully or partially removed customs duties for South Africa's exports to the European Union, except on there's some products that's excluded from this preferential agreement, like aluminium is excluded, and there's also some agricultural products that's still excluded. And of course, we also provided to the European Union preferential access into the SACU market. South Africa, as part of the other members of SACU, made an offer together since we have a common external tariff to the European Union. This agreement also set out the specific rules of origin that governs this preferential market access. So you can only access this preferential duty in each other's market if you meet the rule of origin, and this rule of origin sets out really the level and definition of local content. So what you will make in South Africa that will then make it a South African product that can benefit under this preferential rate that we will have into the EU and the other way around. Of course, it also dealt with some trade remedies were put in place in the EPA to deal with unfair trade, and it also allowed for safeguards. If there's an increase of imports, because of this reduction in our duties that we have, or the preferential duty, it allows that if there's an increase that is causing disturbances in our market, that we are able to put in place a duty again for a period of time to defend or assist our local industries. In terms of our relations with the United Kingdom, is as I've indicated, this trade agreement that we have with the EU governs our current trade also with the United Kingdom. And once the United Kingdom exits the EU, they will also exit, of course, this agreement that is in place between the European Union and the SADC EPAC countries. And that will mean that if we don't have our own arrangement in place with the United Kingdom, that we will have to trade on the most favored nation duty. So this is it's a higher duty that's applied to all other countries in the world. So we will not get the preferential access that we have currently, and the duties are much higher in some instances than what the duties that we currently apply, and that will have effect on our trade. To avoid this disruption in our trade, SACU, Mozambique, and the UK agreed to work towards this rolling over of the terms of the Economic Partnership Agreement to make sure that there is no negative impact on our trade from the UK leaving the EU. The UK is a very important trading partner for South Africa. Currently, in 2018, our total trade, if you exclude some gold products, was over $100 million. If you include the gold products, it goes up to about $143 billion. Our exports to the UK is about increased from 2012 from about $56 billion to $101 billion in 2018. And our imports from the UK also increased from about $22 billion in 2009 to $43 billion in 2018. So you can see that this is a very important export market, but also for some of our imports, and that we have a big positive trade balance in terms of our trade with the United Kingdom. Our top exports to the UK include gold, of course, that make up gold and platinum do make up more than half of our exports to the UK, but we are also exporting motor cars, and this has increased in recent years. Fresh fruits, including citrus, grapes, apples, pears, avos. We're exporting wine. And it's interesting to note that in terms of the UK's imports from the rest of the world, about 44% of the platinum they import comes from South Africa, 22% of the citrus, 20% of grapes, 18% of apricots and peaches, 17% of apples, 5% of their vehicles comes from South Africa, and about 4% of their wine. So also for the UK, we are a significant and important trading partner. We started the discussions on this rollover economic partnership agreement in March 2017, and the broad terms of reference for this discussion that we agreed is that we should ensure the discussions, the focus should be to ensure continuity after the UK exits the EU through this new trade agreement, that this would be a technical exercise rather than a renegotiation of the existing terms, and that there would be some changes necessary to the agreement to make it operable as a standalone agreement between the UK and SACU and Mozambique. The reason for the decision not to make this a whole new negotiations is that the UK is currently still, in terms of their own domestic legislation and also their agreement with the EU, they are unable to negotiate new agreements. They have to negotiate at this stage still agreements as part of the EU. So they have agreed with the EU that they will have these, what you can call a technical negotiations, to roll over the current agreements of the EU into standalone agreements, but not to negotiate new agreements at this stage. As soon as they leave the, or formally exits the EU, they will be able to negotiate their own agreements. So the SACOM, this is Botswana, Eswatini, Lesotho, Mozambique, Namibia and South Africa, have engaged with the UK over a two-year period. We finalized the negotiations on the 7th of September this year, and this new agreement called the SACOM UK EPA will replace the current legal framework of trade between the EU between the UK and the SACU and Mozambique countries, once the EU SADC EPA does not apply anymore to the UK. So if the UK leaves on the 31st of January 2019, as I say, and they leave without a withdrawal agreement, the EPA with the EU will not apply anymore and this agreement will enter into force. 2020. If they leave with a withdrawal agreement on the 31st of January 2020, then the EU EPA agreement will still apply to the UK until the end of December 2020, and then this agreement, the SACOM UK EPA, will enter into force on the 1st of January 2021. So we've made provision in the agreement for any of these eventualities. The key features of the SACOM UK EPA is, as I've indicated, we largely just transposed the terms that was in the SADC UK EPA into a standalone SACOM UK EPA op a mutatis mutandis basis. These will cover the rules for trade and goods, preferential tariff rates on both sides, trade remedies, technical standards for health and safety on agricultural products and also industrial products and also dispute settlement. However, there was five important matters that really took up the bulk of our time in the last 2 years that we had to agree with the UK, and this related to tariff rate quotas that is in the agreement, the sourcing of inputs from the rest of the EU into the UK production for exports and also South African production. So how will we treat UK input in our production processes, the treatment of bilateral safeguard measures, and there were some other transitional arrangements that we also had to agree, and then very importantly, as ministers also indicated, the built-in agenda. So what, once the UK can negotiate their own agreements, what should we look at first? In terms of the tariff rate quotas, all the countries in this, all the SACO countries except South Africa and also Mozambique is receiving duty-free, quota-free treatment from the EU. So they can export any product duty-free and at any volume of products to the EU without paying any duty. So that's the treatment that's given to all of the other countries in the SADC EPA agreement with the EU. However, South Africa did not receive the same treatment. So on some products, we got just a duty-free treatment, but it's only for a specific volume, so that would be the tariff rate quota, or even some of these tariff rate quotas is just at the margin of preference, so we will pay 50% less than the normal duty for a specific volume, and there's also some products that is being phased out, the duty is being phased out over a 5 and 9 year period, that's for fish, and then there's some products where we don't receive any margin of preference, and the same for the UK or the EU into the southern, the SACU market. On some products, we also gave them a tariff rate quota, so they can only export a certain volume under this preferential duty to SACU, and then on some products they only get a margin of preference, and then of course there's products that's excluded. Because of this difference in treatment between South Africa and the other countries in the region, we had to negotiate new volumes in terms of these TRQs, because we couldn't just take over the volume that was agreed with the EU under the tariff rate quota, we had to negotiate our own volumes. And there's 13 products where South Africa is getting a TRQ into the EU market and now into the UK market. And there is also 8 products where the UK is receiving preferential access in terms of a TRQ into the SACU market. So how we decided on this new tariff rate quotas is that we looked at our current exports to the UK on these products and in relation to the TRQ, the volume of the tariff rate quota that's agreed with the EU, and we then decided on a percentage of that that will now be a standalone tariff rate quota for South Africa into the UK and for the UK into SACU. The volumes of our tariff rate quotas with the EU will stay the same. So for example, we have currently in the agreement with the European Union, we have a tariff rate quota of 110 million litres duty-free access for our wine. So that volume will stay exactly as it is when the UK leaves. So it will be for the rest of the 27 countries, that would be the volume. But we will have now a separate volume that would be applicable on wine for our exports to the UK once this agreement enters into force. So if you look at what we've agreed in terms of the TRQs, there's an increase in the total volume that we can then export to the EU 27 plus the UK of for South Africa on average of 38% over what we can currently export, and for the UK 16% increase, and for South Africa on some of the products like sugar and wine there was a much higher increase. So for sugar it's a 49% increase, and for wine it's a 62% increase. So this is from the 110 million litres with the additional volume that we've now agreed with the UK, it's 62% more. So if you look at the next slide, this is just for information, the TRQs that we've agreed with the UK. So for their products, it's on thick fat, pork, barley, wheat, cereal-based food products, butter, cheese and ice cream. We've agreed on some volumes. There's no increase in their volumes each year. It will stay the same. Then for South Africa's products into the UK, on some of the products there would be an annual increase of the volume under the tariff rate quota. That's for strawberries, for canned and tropical fruit, for frozen orange juice, apple juice and for wines. The TRQ volume each year will be increasing by a certain amount. And as you can see, we also have TRQs on skimmed milk powder, butter, cane sugar, white crystal powder, jams, active yeast, and ethanol. So these are the TRQs that we have in place. The other issue that was great concern to not just the UK but also to South Africa is how we will deal with the input currently in our production processes that comes from the European Union. So in terms of this is called accumulation. So currently in terms of our rules of origin with the EU, we can accumulate with a product from the EU in our production of something that we are exporting to the EU. So we can take an engine from the EU and we can use it to manufacture a vehicle, and then when that vehicle are exported for purposes of determining whether we meet the rule of origin, so whether there's enough domestic content, the engine from the EU will be seen as a South African product, as a domestic product, to meet the rule of origin. So that is how our rules currently work. Since we have a highly integrated value chain, especially in products like automotives with the EU, And the UK, of course, have a highly integrated value chain with the EU since they are currently part of the customs union and the common market. We have to find a way to decide that how are we going to deal with this content of the EU into our markets and whether we will accept that in our production processes as being domestic, if you can call it that, or local content for purposes of South Africa exporting to the UK and for purposes of the UK exporting to the EU. So what we've agreed is that for a period of 3 years, while we are waiting for the trade arrangement to be finalized between the UK and the EU, this new trade relationship, that we will accept inputs from the EU into each other's production value chains as being local content for purposes of meeting the rule of origin. Once there's an agreement in place between the UK and the EU, we will see what's the terms of that agreement and how this impact on this arrangement. And we've also agreed that if necessary, we can extend or revise this arrangement for the next 3 years while we get more certainty about what would be the relationship between the UK and the EU once the UK... Then the next issue was the treatment of bilateral safeguards. As I'm sure you're well aware, currently, as I've indicated, we've agreed with the EU that if there is an increase in exports that is causing a disturbance to our own industry, because it's coming at this lower duty, preferential duty, we are able to put in place safeguard duty, so an increase of a duty for a period of time. So currently we do have a safeguard in place on poultry. This duty is being phased out over a period of time, and we have to decide with the UK how we will treat this duty vis-a-vis the UK once they leave the EU. It currently applies to the UK because they're part of the EU, and what we agreed at the end is that this duty will continue to apply, the safeguard duty, against the UK until the duty is phased out also for the EU. So we will be treating the UK and the EU the same, again, issue of continuity to make sure that the trade relationship really stays the same. Another issue is how to deal with the transitional arrangement. So moving from one agreement, trade agreement, to another trade agreement, there would be some impact in terms of our trade because there's going to be new forms, new procedures that people will have to adhere to under the new agreement. So we wanted to make sure that there would be no interruption in our trade while we get these new processes in place and traders get the necessary new documentation. So we agreed with the EU, that the current recognitions for our export for purposes of health and safety, the current establishments in South Africa, production establishments, that is accepted by the EU as meeting their standards, and their SPS standards, their technical standards, that will continue to be accepted by the UK for a period of time until the UK put in place their own system, and also to enable us then to go through the necessary processes with the UK to get these establishments accepted into their model. We will continue to use health model certificates that's issued by the EU for a period of time, and also the certificates of origin. So that's the certificate that must accompany your exports to get the preference, that if it's issued by the EU just before the UK leaves, that we will continue to accept that certificate for a period of time until you can apply for a new certificate of origin traders in terms of the new agreement. So this is really all just arrangements to make sure, administrative arrangements, to make sure that there is no problems with traders on day one when we move from one agreement to another. Then, very importantly, we agreed on a built-in agenda. So these are the issues that we could not finalize in the negotiations now, where, because the UK are limited in terms of what they could negotiate. So we agreed on a number of issues that we want to come back to in future as soon as the UK are able to negotiate their own agreements, The one issue is how they treat our exports into the UK market. So the TRQ volumes, can we increase the TRQ volumes? Can we get duty-free, quota-free treatment for those products? So it is really to look at our preferential market access, whether we can renegotiate that. Then, very importantly, and this linked to the discussion, the issue that we've raised earlier, that we wanted to be able to continue to use input from the EU in our production to export to one another, is how we will treat regional accumulation. So currently, under the agreement that we have with the EU, and it will be the same for now under the agreement with the UK, we can use any input from our neighbours. So we can take any product from Botswana, Eswatini, Lesotho, Namibia, and from Botswana in our production process in South Africa. It will be seen as a local product for purposes of us meeting the rule of origin, South Africa, to export to the UK or to the EU. However, the other countries in the region cannot do the same in terms of imports from South Africa. So if we do not have, on that specific product, South Africa duty-free, quota-free treatment into the EU or the UK, then Botswana or Lesotho or Eswatini, Namibia, Mozambique, they will not be able to use that input in their production for purposes of meeting the rule of origin to export to the EU. So just an example, currently Eswatini imports pears and peaches from Greece to can them and to export it to the UK, because they cannot use peaches and pears from South Africa, because we do not have duty-free, quota-free treatment to the UK for peaches and pears. So that sort of scenario, that is what we want to address once the UK can negotiate their own agreements. A time frame of 18 months was set to ensure that we can fully accumulate, we can develop regional value chain, we can integrate in the region also for purposes of our production and exports to the EU and the exports to the UK. The other issue is treatment of vehicles with engine capacity of 1,000 cc's and less. This is an issue that we also raised with the EU and we're in discussions with them. Export taxes, in terms of the agreement with the UK and with the EU, we can only have, under certain circumstances, export taxes and also only a certain number of export taxes. So we would want to rediscuss and renegotiate how we deal with export taxes under this new agreement. We're also looking at enhanced cooperation on TBT, and there's some issues on geographical indicators, and that's our GIs, in terms of our wine and our wine practices, that we will also want to further discuss under this built-in agenda once the UK leaves the EU. In terms of the way forward then, as I've indicated in the beginning, it is not clear when this agreement will enter into force. It will depend on the various scenarios, but we want to make sure that whether it is the 1st of January, the 1st of February 2020, whether it's the 1st of January 2021, whether it's a later date, if there's another extension, that we have the necessary agreement in place to ensure that there's a continuity in our trade. So the entering into force agreement provision in this agreement is very clearly set out that this agreement will enter into force once everyone has ratified or the UK has provisionally applied. So the UK can provisionally apply the agreement, they don't have to ratify at this stage. But once that is in place, that if the agreement, the SADC EU EPA that we have with the EU, if that does not apply, the date that does not apply anymore to the UK, this agreement will enter into force. And therefore, Chair, with just having given this bit of background in terms of what the agreement entails and with what the Minister has indicated earlier, so that according to South Africa's constitutional obligations, we have to go through a ratification process. We wish to request the committee to consider the ratification of this agreement to then enter into force once the issues between the UK and the EU is sorted out. The UK formally exits the EU and the SADC EU EPA does not apply to the UK any longer. Thank you.
I would actually then request that maybe the committee members, if ever they've got any clarity seeking questions or comments, can we then pick up on that? McPherson, Cuthbert, Thring, Mulder, any further heads? Okay. Can I take, Mantasha? Can I take those hands?
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you, Minister, to you and your team. And as I'll reiterate the DA's position that that we congratulate you on being able to achieve this this deal. I know a lot of hard work has gone into it, and hopefully we will see much success coming out of it once the UK has made up its mind as to which way it's going to proceed. I also think that this presents a big opportunity for South Africa to increase its trade, not just in volume per se, but also in the products in which we trade. And so I would like to start seeing from your team a work plan as to how we can look to deal with some of the very thorny issues around phytosanitary regulation, which unfortunately is outsourced to the Department of Agriculture and Fisheries, because that is going to be a key issue if we are to expand our beef and poultry exports into the UK, which we haven't been particularly successful due to the EPA in previous years. I think that there's also a big opportunity to expand our offering and trade and services into the UK. So I would hate for us to miss this opportunity to just try and maintain the status quo, but to really see this as a foundation as to which we could build on. I've been critical of the last Parliament that that these sorts of discussions tend to take place in lofty rooms between the executive, when in fact it's actually up to MPs to really grapple with these trade deals and approve the ratification in Parliament of them, and also to be able to sell these deals to their constituents. And so I would ask of the department that you see us as your partners as to implementing these trade deals and your partners as to growing the opportunities for export of South African products, goods and services into the UK. But I think that it would be helpful if we can start to see a long-term plan as to how we can use this as a foundation to go forward across other sectors to start, getting the DAF ready for the opportunities that will come from this new deal and to obviously use us as a resource to take this deal forward. Thank you.
Cuthbert.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, I just wanted to pose one question, and that relates to the citrus black spot in particular, what negotiations have taken place around that. Because I had a conversation with an EU official a week or two ago, and they seem to be steadfast in the fact that they are not going to change their phytosanitary standards in order to accommodate citrus black spot. So is there some leverage for us to use in negotiating this deal with the UK? And if it could please be provided with the details thereof. Thank you, Chair.
Thring.
Thank you, Chair. It has been said that when the United States and China have engaged in their trade wars, it affects the rest of the world, including South Africa. It seems as if Brexit has the same kind of effect in terms of particularly the time and the effort and the energy that has to go in, and I think perhaps we should look at sending a bill to the UK just in terms of the time that it's taking for affected countries to put into place some of these trade agreements. That being said, Chair, just some simple questions. I noticed that Zimbabwe is not included in the SACOM agreement. Why not? The TRQ positives, I think, were adequately and well explained, that it will result in an increase in our exports to the UK. Are there any negatives? Will we see a reciprocal response where there could be an increase, percentage increase in imports to South Africa? We are increasing our exports, and that's the positive. And I heard you also say that we are protecting, in particular, our poultry industry in that particular regard. But are there any other areas where we could possibly see an increase in imports? And if so, what would those be? Another simple question, TBT. I didn't pick up the acronym, so just what is the TBT? And then the ratification, Minister, I know that you dealt with that in September. My understanding was that most parties supported the agreement. Has the process of ratification in South Africa been concluded? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, from my and the Freedom Front Plus side, also I wish to congratulate the Minister and the team again on the outcomes of the negotiations. Just a couple of short questions, nothing serious. It's been mentioned on page 4 that duties on, EPA and the European Union has fully or partially removed custom duties for South African exports except aluminium and some agriculture products. Just a question on that. Is this arrangement different from what it was beforehand? Then the second question is mentioned on page 12. The UK TRQ average rates were increased by 16%. I'm not quite sure what does it actually mean. Why will this rates increase? Because there are certain numbers mentioned here, while average South African rates will increase by 38% with growth of sugar and wine volumes. And just last question is, was there any reservations while negotiating this new deal? I was just thinking something in the line of, I see the American government is reconsidering duty-free import of certain South African products regarding the amendment bill on copyright, for instance. Was there any reservation similar to that? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, we rise to applaud the work done by this department and its team in traveling this long road up to this far. And we continue to pledge our support for the ratification of this deal, of this agreement, Chair. We're having our reservations as we go forward, but we plead with them to ensure that they protect the sovereignty of our country in whatever thing they do in signing any agreement. Thank you very much.
Minister, I'm sure we can ask that you comment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and first thank you. I really appreciate on behalf of the team the very warm comments that have been made. We're in this as South Africa as a team, and I think we've seen now with the comments across many remarks by members of Parliament that we're all looking at making South Africa win, and I'm not only talking about the rugby. I'm going to respond to some of the more policy-centric issues, and Nikki may want to take up some of the specific matters that have come up. Honourable McPherson made an offer that we should see the committee and members of Parliament as a resource, particularly in ensuring that we can take forward the openings, the windows that have been created in the trade agreement, and I really welcome that. I think we can now begin to bat strongly for South African exports, and as members of Parliament engage with foreign investors and with businesses across the world, one of the selling points of South Africa is that we have largely duty-free access to the UK market, that notwithstanding the UK's likely withdrawal from the European Union, South Africa would have preferential access to the UK market and to the European Union market. So that's a selling point, and it's one that I would urge members of Parliament, in the spirit of what Honourable McPherson has indicated, to communicate on a regular basis. We would do the same as government, and it's a great reinforcement. The second issue that's been raised by Honourable McPherson is that we need to look at this as, yes, on the one hand, it creates stability for our trade relationship, but why don't we use this now to leverage some additionality? And it's an area we've begun to think about. And you will see, therefore, that with the TRQs, it would give us an opportunity to at least expand our exports for the aggregate of the European Union and the UK. In addition to that, we should also see it as an opportunity to diversify the trade with the UK, to sell more value-added products. We're doing very well on cars, but we need to expand the number of products where value addition takes place. Exporting raw materials, the world will always look to us for raw materials, but it's not the best exports. It must be part of your basket. But the best exports is when you can add value locally, and so we'll be looking at that. Using the example of the SBS, which the Honourable Member referred to, we have now had a set of engagements with the Department of Agriculture and with the private sector, with the poultry industry, to look at improving the SPSs, the sanitary and phytosanitary, let's call it the health standards that applies in our chicken industry, so that when we seek to export chicken meat, countries like the UK and others have no grounds to object to our chicken based on concerns about the health standards at the chicken farms and in the slaughtering process. So we are now busy with that, and we hope that we can make a breakthrough which should apply both to the UK as well as more generally. We've begun to make some success on the beef side compared to previously. Honourable members would know that or may know that some 10 years ago our export of beef was very, very modest. We're now beginning to export beef in increasing quantities, particularly to the Middle East, more recently to China. But we'd like to break into the markets of Europe more substantially, and of course, United States, Latin America. We'd like to sell to the whole world. We have no particular preference. As long as it creates jobs in South Africa, it's a good thing. So all those remarks are well made, and we certainly will be looking at the plan to increase the growth of trade, particularly exports to the UK. on Honourable Cuthbert's point about the citrus black spot, I'd like to make two remarks. One is, there is no scientific basis for the European Union's contention that citrus black spot provides a basis for limiting the export of South African citrus to their markets. It is, in our view, naked protectionism. It's utilizing a cosmetic feature and giving it a character that there is no scientific basis to. And it is something that we are raising with the European Union, given its repeated statements that it seeks to be a partner in development, that it should in fact drop the objection to South African citrus fruits based on the CBS consideration. Of course, in these particular talks with the UK, the issue of what are the kind of grounds on which SPS can be invoked, in other words, does this or that particular issue come in, was not part of the discussion. But we are now able to use the EPA to have the conversation with the UK should they introduce any restrictions on South African citrus through this agreement. To date, all of our exports to the UK has been governed by the EU EPA. Depending on what happens with the talks between Britain and the EU, should future trade be regulated, or when future trade is regulated by this EPA, the UK EPA, we can then deal with the citrus black spot more easily. And bearing in mind that in our view, and I express the opinion of government, the citrus black spot is really about protecting citrus growers in Europe. And since Britain doesn't really have citrus growing as an industry, we are hopeful that we can ensure that. We do have access for our citrus fruit into Europe, of course, but it's our very success that now suddenly take a small cosmetic issue on an orange or on a lemon and elevates it as if it is a ground for exclusion. So I think that we will keep an eye on this matter in respect of the UK. We have not had a problem with the UK on citrus black spot to date, but should it become an issue, of course, we can engage further. Honourable Tring makes a really nice point that the fallout between the EU and the UK has had a cost to South Africa, including, of course, the cost of our diverting our staff, time, energy and attention to the conclusion of the EPA. And it's a cute idea that we should be sending the ball. But on a more serious thing, the reason why Zimbabwe is not included in this is we took the parties that were part of the current EPA that South Africa is a party to with the European Union. So those same parties are now party to the UK EPA. So that's why we call them SACUM. It's a very strange acronym because it's SACU plus Mozambique. So Zimbabwe was not part of that particular arrangement, and to keep matters simple and expedite the conclusion of an agreement, we thought let's keep it to the same parties. Of course, the UK has entered into talks with a number of other countries more recently and previously to try to get similar agreements as what we have concluded. On the ratification process, it's an important question that Honourable Tring raises. Once this committee recommends to the National Assembly the ratification of this, and once the Select Committee similarly does that, the parliamentary processes would take over the National Assembly when Parliament, in fact, in its full sitting, the gavel is banged, if I use that that analogy, then at that point it becomes legally binding. Honourable Mulder, I'm sure Nikki will comment on the aluminium issue, but generally none of the terms have been changed. They've just made sure that there's been an attempt not to give us more in specific areas, but Nikki can deal with a specific issue. You do raise, though, the question whether there are reservations. Are there some issues that we're concerned about? Are there some issues that they're concerned about? I would say that the area that the UK was particularly concerned about was poultry. We have a safeguard duty in place against poultry coming in from Europe. There was a surge in European poultry coming into our markets, so we put additional duties on in accordance with the rules that are applicable. The UK initially said to us that safeguard duty cannot apply to them once they leave the European Union. And we held firm that since that safeguard duty was applied whilst they were a member, it should continue until the safeguard duty itself comes to an end. So the safeguard duty arrangement was an area of concern. There were other areas of concern that the UK raised, and each of these were dealt with in this way. We kept to the principle that South Africa cannot be any worse off as a result of the UK leaving the European Union, and we held the ground on that one. As regards South Africa's position, of course we sought to have some areas of improvement. We are a developing country. We have enormous challenges of unemployment, poverty and inequality. So we've made the point to the UK that we are looking at some improvement in the terms applicable to South Africa. And those areas have been largely parked in the built-in agenda. So let me give an example of that. In the arrangement with the European Union at the moment, there is an increase in the importation of vehicles with an engine capacity of below 1,000 cc. Now, when we entered into the original agreement with Europe, years back, cars were generally 1,100 and above. Honorable members of a certain age will reveal their age by nodding in agreement with me. So we were quite happy to have a 1,000 cc and above arrangement in place on the assumption that would apply to cars, and below 1,000 cc would apply to things like the engines of golf carts and lawn mowers and so on. But technology has moved on, and today you can have cars powered by engines that are below 1,000 cc. So that has become a loophole that has led to export of vehicles to our market in a way that was not contemplated when many years ago the agreement was crafted. So we are in discussion with the European Union to fix this loophole, but of course Europe is now saying, well, if you want to fix that loophole, we have a few other things we'd also like to talk to you about. So this is an area that we've now said to the UK, we'd like to fix this. And it's now put into what is called a built-in agenda. What that means is we're signing this off so that we've got stability, but these other concerns that we have don't disappear. We will now talk about them. As soon as we conclude an agreement, we can then incorporate those terms into the future trade arrangements between ourselves and the UK. So there's quite a few areas, and Nikki has drawn attention to that in the presentation, and the honourable members will also see it in the text of the agreement itself. Honourable Mantash, thank you very much for your very warm comments, and for us now, of course, the hard work starts as soon as Parliament ratifies, because then we need to make sure that we are able to expand exports to the United Kingdom, that we can sell more goods there, and we can create more jobs for South Africans. There were a few more specific and technical questions, and we were not going to fly Nikki down from Pretoria without her showing her considerable expertise. So I may I, Chairperson, defer to her to dazzle the committee with her knowledge. Thank you.
You're putting me under pressure, Minister. maybe just before I go to the specific issues, maybe just on Zimbabwe to indicate that Zimbabwe have their own agreement as part of a different grouping with the UK. They've already signed it, and that's already in place. They're part of the Eastern and Southern African group. This is a, don't want to go into detail, but this is an issue that we've raised with the EU on many occasions, that when they started to negotiate the economic partnership agreements, they decided how to divide Africa. So they did not negotiate with us in terms of our own regional economic community. So it was not the whole of SADC, the Southern African Development Community. They took some members in SADC and put them in one group. Some members of SADC, like Zimbabwe, Mauritius, myself, were put in another grouping. So they did their own divide of Africa. And those are issues that many countries, including South Africa, are still raising in terms of the EPAs and the effectiveness of the EPAs also to assist with regional integration. But then I think some of the specific issues was the TRQs. I mean, there's an increase, of course, for South Africa in various areas like wine and sugar. But there's also going to be an increase in terms of volumes coming into South Africa on some other products, and whether we see any other areas where there may be a concern that there would be an increase of imports that may affect the domestic market. Currently, in terms of the sort of products that we are trading with the UK or importing from the UK, except, of course, poultry, where the UK was also a big exporter when the safeguard was done. We don't foresee it in the near future that there would be a significant increase in terms of the imports because of this agreement from the EU. We will have to see how it develops, but what we do have in place, if that happens, we have to save a safeguard in place. So the same safeguard provision that's in our agreement with the EU that we utilize to put in place this protection for the poultry industry, we have the same provision in place also in our agreement with the UK. So if there's an increase of any product to such an extent that it is causing a disturbance to our domestic producers or manufacturers, then we will be able, in terms of the agreement, to also put the necessary protection in place to assist them for a period of time to adapt to the competition. Then in terms of what is TBT, apologies, that's technical barriers to trade. So you have sanitary and phytosanitary measures that deals with the health relating issues on plant and animal health. And then TBT, or technical barriers to trade, that deals with the technical regulations that countries put in place if you want to export to them. So if you want to export a vehicle, it needs to meet some technical regulations or TBs or any, most products will have some sort of TBT regulation in place. And we want to have better cooperation between our authorities that deal with this, like the SABMS and then the authorities in the UK, that there's certainty in terms of what is the regulation and if there's any changes, that we will get sufficient time to enable our manufacturers to meet then that standard that is set up in the UK. Then I think there was another issue about is there, in terms of aluminium, We don't have preferential market access in the EU. So this is a issue that comes over from what we've agreed with the EU. So on certain products, we don't have duty-free access or any access, preferential access into the EU. That same restrictions is put into the agreement with the UK. So there isn't, it's not new, a new duty that we have negotiated in terms of our agreement with the UK. We took over everything as is in terms of the preferential trade, except the tariffed quotas where we negotiated new volumes. And I think that brings me to the question that was asked about what does this mean, this increase in the rate of 16% and 38%. This is just that if you look at the volume that was agreed under the TRQs with the EU, and you look at what was now agreed with the UK, there's been an increase in terms of access under the TRQs for the whole of the EU, so that's the EU 27 plus the EU, this new UK volume, there's a 16% increase in terms of what can be exported under this TRQs to South Africa on average. And then in terms of what we can export to the EU 27 and then to the UK, in terms of the two volumes, there's an increase of 38%, the average increase. But for wine and sugar, as I've indicated, a much bigger increase because the volumes that we've agreed with the UK is a big volumes that we've agreed, because most of our exports on some of these products, or a significant part of our current exports to the whole of the EU, goes to the UK. So the volumes that was agreed was quite significant. For wine, as I said, it's 70 million. While the current volume is 110 million, so overall we will have 180 million litre of duty-free export of wine that will go then to the EU 27 plus to the UK if you combine the two. I think that's the, Minister, I think those are the issues that was more specifically raised, the technical issues.
Allow me to thank Minister and Mr. K. Kruger for the presentation. I do have a report to consider circulated to members. Just maybe read through. Report of the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry on the Economic Partnership Agreement between the Southern African Custom Union Member States and Mozambique of one part and the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland of the other part, dated 29th October 2019. The Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, having considered the request for approval by Parliament on the Economic Partnership Agreement between the Southern African Custom Union Member States and Mozambique of the one part and the United Kingdom of the Great Britain and Northern Ireland of the other part, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 231.2 of the Constitution, approve the said agreement. So I'm putting before the committee for us to be able to proceed and agree with the report of the committee. If I can just get members covered.
Chair, the DA welcomes this agreement and would like to accept this particular proposal.
As a mover, Hermans.
Thank you, Chair. The African National Congress, noting the good work done by the department, seconds the ratification of this agreement.
We will thank Minister and Kruger to be able to actually then proceed to the next part of our program. Can we take a 10-minute break? It should be tea time, but I think it's close to lunch. It's generally called brunch. Thank you very much. 10 minutes, we can reconvene. It's not afternoon. It's still a good day, DG. Floor is yours. We can be able to proceed. Okay.
Chairperson, members of the Portfolio Committee. Now, we, in terms of the introduction, I would like to introduce the team from the department. Just very quickly, the CFO of the department and the economist in the department. Also, I would like to introduce the Competition Commission and the commissioner, Mr. Bonakele, and then also the deputy commissioner, James Hodge. The presentation, Chairperson, is such that it has got the details of the Competition Act itself, that is the principal act. We felt that, Chairperson, in order for the committee to be one and read from the same page about this phenomenon, it's important that you actually get the understanding of the principal act itself, which is the Competition Act of 1998. Mm. Now, thereafter, we'll then indicate what actually happened when it was reviewed, and then why it was reviewed. Mm. After that review, what were the changes that were actually proposed to be made, and why those changes? Then we get into the amended act itself, which is the amended act of 2018. Now, again, even there, we'll then say what were the amended sections, and what do those sections mean? Those details, Chairperson, I would actually ask the Competition Commission, right, to talk to those details. What I would then do myself, I would actually deal with the implementation of the Competition Amendment Act. What did the department do itself, right, in the preparation for that, now at the state of it, to ensure the right state of readiness for the Competition Commission to take those amendments forward. I will then speak to those. At the moment, I would invite the commissioner to actually to talk to that history. Yes.
I think we will do the introduction as well. If ever we can just make sure, because we can't take for granted that the members are actually knowing everyone who's here. So if ever maybe DG, it will be good just for the team to introduce themselves. It will be well and good, so that at least we have the same recognition across the room. Okay, floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Chair and DG. My name is Thembi Nkosi Bonakele. I'm the Commissioner of the Competition Commission.
And my name is James Hodge. I'm the Chief Economist and Acting Deputy Commissioner.
Chair, my name is Bukosi Bake Majenge. I'm the Manager for Legal Services and also Acting Deputy Commissioner. Thank you.
Good day. I'm Irene Ramafola, the CFO of the Economic Development. Thank you.
And it's Len Frevé, economist with DTIC. Thanks.
Irshad Kathrada, advisor to the minister.
Right, Ntabeleng Poko, Office of the Deputy Minister, Majola.
Shirisi Majinani, Senior Communications Officer, the DTI.
Sidon Midupi from the DTI.
You can proceed. Those we want on record, they're already on record now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair, and I would like to thank you for inviting us to join today's proceedings. We are coming for the first time here as the Competition Commission, and we are delighted to meet members of the Portfolio Committee. I don't know if it is late, but I would like to congratulate them on being elected as MPs and as members of this committee, and we look forward to working with you. We kind of deliberated about what would be the best way to utilize the time we have to talk about both the Principal Act as well as the amendments. And so we decided that we are going to give you as much information as possible in the slides for background, because we wouldn't have time to cover everything. But at the same time, we also thought that there are maybe a few things that may not necessarily be in the slides that we may also want to just mention, just to provide context. The act we are talking about is the Competition Act of 1998, and it provides a framework for competition authorities, and it creates the structures. So perhaps what's not in the slide, Chair, which I just have to mention very quickly, is that we have the Act that creates three bodies, the Competition Commission, which is ourselves here. The Competition Commission is really the first point of call, interaction between members of the public and the authorities. We are there to investigate complaints, regulate measures, and above us is the Competition Tribunal, which is an adjudicative body, first-line adjudicative body. So we prosecute our cases before the tribunal. And there is also a specialist court which is created by this act, which is the Competition Appeal Court, which is headed by Judge Dennis Davis. Appeals from the tribunal are appealed to that court. And anything else then that arises, emanates from that court, can be appealed to the Constitutional Court, unless it's a normal kind of issue that typically would be appealed to the Supreme Court of Appeal. But if it's a matter of substance of competition, it will start with the Tribunal, Competition Appeal Court, and then the Constitutional Court. I mention this because from time to time I think we are going to be referring to these levels, because they are all critical for decision making. So the Competition Commission is the one that investigates transgressions of the Competition Act, and we would then prosecute them before the tribunal. The tribunal will make a determination and may impose penalties where they find that anti-competitive conduct has occurred. Just in terms of what is prohibited, the Act sometimes uses complicated language, but it really is the types of agreements is the first thing that's prohibited. So there are agreements that we sometimes refer to as cartels or collusion. These are price fixing, where people get together and fix prices. These are market allocation. So if people decide, instead of competing, that they will allocate markets to each other, they could do this geographically, for example. They could say, I will operate in the Eastern Cape and you'll operate in the Western Cape, and in that way they avoid competition. There is also sometimes what we call bid rigging or tender collusion, and this is where you have an invitation to tender, and instead of people tendering individually, they get together. Sometimes they will allocate by rotation who will get the tender. Sometimes they will help each other to win the tender. So this could be things like, you know, I will submit a bid that's almost like fake. Maybe I'll charge a higher price and you then get to be the lowest. And then you get appointed, and next time around you also help me. So that this is how. So this is the first set of agreements that are unlawful, and we prosecute. The second level is what we call vertical. These are agreements that typically would be between like a supplier and a customer. There are certain things that also a supplier cannot do to a customer. A typical example of this, I think, is the retail price maintenance. So if you sell me a product, you may not tell me how much I should sell that product for. That agreement would be unlawful. So if, and you know, we've had the famous cases on this where the OEMs, the auto manufacturers, that sell cars to dealerships, they may not tell dealerships at what price they must resell those cars. And we've had a case in the past where they did that and they were penalized for that conduct. And the third line is what is there, called abuse of dominance, which includes things like price discrimination, excessive pricing, predatory pricing, and exclusionary conduct. I'll simplify that by saying, when you are dominant, and the Act defines dominance by reference to the market shares that you have, there are certain responsibilities that you have in the market. I'll give you an example. If you are dominant and we all rely on you in order to be able to sell our products, how you behave in relation to us is regulated by law. Perhaps, again, it's easier to use an example here. We had a case in the past where Telkom was dominant in infrastructure. They owned most of the infrastructure for telecommunications. And internet service providers depended on Telkom to sell their products. And Telkom was preferring their own business that was competing with them. So they were also in internet services. So they would give lower price to their own business and sometimes exclude these internet service providers. Again, Telkom was prosecuted for that. That's an example where a dominant firm has a responsibility, because even though they own the infrastructure, the Act requires that they may not exclude others unfairly from using that infrastructure. So that is the enforcement part of our work, if you like. I've tried to summarize it. It's quite complex, obviously. The second part is what is in the second main bullet there, which is the regulation of mergers. And there we have a notification requirement in South Africa for all mergers that meet a particular threshold, which is determined by the minister. So those measures can be assessed by us and approved depending on their impact on competition in the market or on public interest. Now, public interest would include things like employment, things like industrial sector or region, historically disadvantaged people's participation in a market, and so on. So those are all public interest grounds we would take into account. Sorry, Chair, I'm not a public speaker, naturally. I again, members, I don't have much time to talk about everything in measures. I think in future we'll be able to share with you some of the cases we've done. But just in terms of the legal framework, there are three categories of measures. These are all dependent on the size of the business. And we look at the size of business based on its turnover or asset base. So there are thresholds for small measures. So small measures don't have to be notified. So if two spaza shops are merging, those don't have to be notified. But there are intermediate measures, or what you could say mid-sized measures. Those get notified to us, we can take a decision on them. And then there are large measures. Large measures, we also do a similar assessment as intermediate measures, but we don't decide. We refer those to the tribunal with a recommendation. Small measures, if they are problematic, we can still call for their notification. We can approve the measures, we can prohibit them, or we can impose conditions. Now, the background to the principal act is perhaps well captured in the preamble to the act, and I will read quickly the relevant parts of this preamble that I want to highlight. It provides that the people of South Africa recognize that apartheid and other discriminatory laws and practices of the past resulted in excessive concentration of ownership and control within the economy. Secondly, it says that the economy must be open to greater ownership by a greater number of South Africans. I'm going to jump that because I think you can also read for yourselves, but those are the things I wanted to highlight. It further... I want to come to the purposes of the Act. The purposes of the Act themselves are provided for inside the statute, so this is beyond the preamble now. These are substantive provisions. The Act provides that the purpose of the Act is to promote and maintain competition in the Republic. In order to, one, promote the efficiency, adaptability, and development of the economy. So this recognizes that competition will make our economy more efficient and agile. Two, to provide consumers with competitive prices and product choice. This recognizes the role of competition policy in making sure that consumers pay competitive prices and that there is a wider choice of products in the market. Three, to promote employment and advance the social and economic welfare of South Africans. This is one of the public interest issues that is, I would say, fairly uniquely South African. Four, to expand opportunities for South African participation in world markets and recognize the role of foreign competition in the Republic. I think that's self-explanatory. Five, to ensure that SMMEs have an equitable opportunity to participate in the economy. And six, to promote greater spread of ownership, in particular to increase the ownership stakes of historically disadvantaged persons. Then is the background to the Competition Act. Now, this act has been in enforcement for the past 20 years. I'm going back now to the first slide. I'm sorry to do this to you. This act has been in place for the past 20 years. We've done a publication, Chair, which we will share with you on the 20-year review. I will not talk about that today, but I want to talk about a few lessons that have led to the debate around amendments. So the first thing is that over the past 20 years, there is recognition that the South African economy remains concentrated. It's one of the most highly concentrated in the world. We ourselves as a commission have done a study looking at our data on measures, and we have found that in most sectors, 75% of sectors in the South African economy can be described as concentrated. This is confirmed by studies. For example, the World Bank confirms this, the OECD confirms this, and that this concentration imposes a huge constraint to growth. So that's the first thing, is that a concentrated economy cannot grow adequately. Second thing is it's exclusionary. So if you want an inclusive economy, so if you want entrants, SMMEs participating, black people participating, women participating, you've got to address this issue of concentration, because it takes away opportunities for SMMEs and black entrepreneurs. Our experience is that this concentration has been worsened or aggravated by abuse of dominance by large firms. Our case list is littered with, for example, large firms excluding small players from participating in the markets. So if in South Africa, for example, you want to sell any product, retail is kind of 65% concentrated amongst the four largest retailers. So if you are producing potatoes, that's your market. Those are the people who sell most potatoes in the country. So you are dependent. They are like a gatekeeper for you to be able to enter the market. And you find that in many sectors of the economy. We've had situations, for example, where local producers in steel, in polymers, like plastic inputs, local buyers, manufacturers who use these products were charged more than people who were importing this stuff from South Africa. So we have a case list on that. So that just worsens matters, because it means then SMMEs are hugely disadvantaged. This has led to a debate about how then do you restructure the Competition Act in order to be able to take care of these problems. Of course, what I didn't mention is that a concentrated economy also enables cartels. So if you have fewer players, we've had a prosecution of the bread cartel in South Africa. Now, if you have only a few players like we have, three players who produce the bulk of bread consumed, it's possible for those players to get together and determine the price. It would be impossible if you just had 20 producers of bread, because coordination would make it impossible for that cartel to operate. But because our market is so concentrated, you were able to get everybody in one room and they fixed the price of bread. So this is part of the problem that is caused by concentration in an economy. And in South Africa, that was enabled by concentration in milling, because a lot of people can bake bread, but not everybody can mill flour. And so access to this was also dependent on the large players. So what now has happened is that all of these have led to a review of the Competition Act, which was undertaken by Economic Development Department, and they identified some areas of change. I'm on the slide that says review of the Principal Act.
And the focus, the areas, the number one was to focus on the impact of anti-competitive conduct on SMMEs and firms that are owned by black South Africans. Already I have indicated how these are impacted by concentration. The secondly was to directly address economic concentration as a structural issue in the economy. As I have said, it impacts on growth and dynamism. Thirdly, on strengthening the regulator so that it could be able to address abuse of dominance by large enterprises, and to align competition-related processes and decisions with other public entity policies, programs, and interests, to strengthen the role of competition authorities and the executive in certain competition issues. And the purposes of the amendment is to open up the economy to greater investment in new businesses with the focuses on, as I have mentioned, focusing on SMMEs and black-owned enterprises, to provide the competition authorities with better tools to investigate and address high levels of concentration, to strengthen the public interest objectives of the Competition Act in order to more directly deal with economic transformation and inclusion. But they also said that they wanted to maintain the basic architecture of the Act, but align it with operations with stated purposes. Because sometimes there was no direct alignment between the purposes, which I mentioned earlier, with the substantive provisions. So EGD wanted to strengthen that. One of the benefits intended by the Competition Amendment Act are in this next slide. I will not go through all of those in the interest of time, because it sort of gets repetitive. So that's now the end of my part on the principal act and the processes that led to the review of the act. And I think the DG will now take us through the amendment process, as well as my two colleagues who will have something to say about that. Thank you.
Chairperson, thank you very much. With that background of exactly how the Competition Act came into being and the Amendment Act, it came to be in the reasons well thereafter. Now, thereof. Now, I wanted just to take the committee as to exactly what happened when the President then approved the Amendment Act. Recall, Chairperson, that the Amendment Act was approved February of 2019, that is this year. Now, of course, that picture is not very clear, but what then happened is that in July, before that act it could be implemented, there should be a promulgation of the sections that were identified, right? In that slide, we are listing the actual sections, right, in the Principal Act that were amended. And what would happen after I've made my presentation, then the Competition Commission, the economist, the chief economist, will then go into the details on the implications, why those specific amendment actions, sections were actually made, and how far we are in actually implementing them. But before he does that, I do want to just to talk to what has happened in the department. Remember that I said that in the department we wanted to make sure that the Competition Commission is ready to actually to implement those sections that are that are listed in the previous slide. Now, what happened, Chairperson, the minister actually established to ensure that the Competition Commission is ready, established a temporary expert panel. That expert panel was intended to advise him on the areas of efficacy of the competition authority. Now, I say authority, Chairperson, competition authority. When I say authority, I'm including the competition tribunal. Then they had to look into both the Competition Commission and the tribunal to make sure that themselves they are ready to actually to implement that. They also had to look into the administrative capacity in those two institutions. Now, in the slide there, I'm actually outlining four key areas that were lifted, that were recommended by the panel itself. The first area of recommendation was to ensure that there are systems that are in place, there are also appropriate resources that are required in the implementation of those acts. One of the things that it actually did, it was to consider the current organizational structure of the commission and also its iterations to actually to implement these changes of the Amendment Act. One of the recommendations in the system, in the implementation of that system, was actually to say that the Competition Commission, it will require restructuring, and in doing that restructuring, you'll have to consider the work to be done in terms of the skills audit to be able to satisfy ourselves that the resources that are there are appropriate to actually to take this process forward. But it actually underscored the importance of actually getting an organizational design expert who would actually assist the Competition Commission to make sure that the structure that comes out is a structure that will be able to fulfill the recommendations that are expected to be implemented. One of the other areas that it pointed out is that when you recruit resources into the commission, it's important that you should actually strike a balance between the insourcing of resources, that is people that you appoint full-time in your structure. But however, it's important to also to consider the outsourcing model. Outsourcing model is actually, it's a situation where you need a resource that you may not afford if you were to appoint it full-time in your staff establishment, but be able to get that resource to come in and do that specific task. The example that I make there, Chairperson, is that you could actually appoint a senior counsel with 10 years experience, right? But if you have got you need a counsel with 10 years experience, you'll not be able to pay that in your salary bill, but be able to bring it so that it performs the work that you actually want. So the point that the panel actually recommended is that the institution, it should use both those methods of actually recruiting. Otherwise, you will have an exponential spending, right, that will actually kill your budget if you don't use those balancing acts. The other recommendation that it actually made was that amongst the deputy commissioners, You should actually appoint more than one, because in the past we had only one deputy commissioner, which was working with the commissioner. Now, this time around, we say you need more than one deputy commissioner. One of those deputy commissioners, it should be a deputy commissioner who actually is able to deal with the administrative functions and management, in other words, to release the commissioner from being bogged down into those operational issues that are not core-related. And you will then see there with it speaks about a COO, so to speak. The other areas that were recommended by the panel is that, now, we had a problem, Chairperson, about the funding model, whether our competition commission, as it stands, the way that we are funding it, is appropriate. So one of the requirements for this panel was actually for themselves to look at other jurisdictions, in Africa and outside Africa, where there is competition law, and see how those entities are actually funded. At the end, they came back to say that the current model that we are using to fund the Competition Commission, we should continue with it. What is that model? They are funded through a government grant. We should continue to fund them through a government grant. They are also funded through the filing of measure fees. And then the last funding, which is the third stream, is the interest earned on the levied penalties. Then they agreed that we should continue with that. Now, that area is an area that we have been discussing with the Treasury, so that we are one in terms of how we see the Competition Commission being funded. I'll speak to that when I talk about the financial implications later on. The other area that they came out with is the need to strengthen what we term ministerial protocol, because the executive authority, in terms of the Amendment Act, the mandate of the executive authority has been extended. Now, then the question there is that, are we able to have around the ministry a system that is put in place to be able to handle confidential documents that are actually filed by companies that are participating in the measures? The third area was the area of the caseload. In the nature of the Competition Commission, there are a number of legal cases that they deal with. Now, the question there was, is this current system that is actually being used in the Competition Commission, is it appropriate? The answer there was that the cash management system that is being used currently is adequate. But however, they actually propose that we should have a case management committee. It is this committee that will actually be looking at the case pipeline and engage with the teams that are actually dealing with the processing of those cases, but they must first go through that case management committee, and itself, it will also be the one that will ultimately recommend to the commission. When I say commission, Chairperson, commission in terms of the act there, it means is the commissioner and the deputy commissioners together. Now, this committee will actually guide in future those recommendations that go to that body. That was the fourth area around the resources and the system, how the system should actually be be improved. Now, the fourth area, Chairperson, that I wanted just to speak to there is that, which I say is another significant action that we had to take to prepare for the implementation of this Amendment Act, is that there is the NMOC. The NMOC is the process that government is engaged in terms of the reconfiguration of government. Right. Within the NMOC, we actually made it a point that the merger that has happened between the Department of the DTI and the Department of the EDD, there should actually be a function which we call competition function, because that function is a critical function. Right. Hence, the department in future now is known as the DTIC. It's because you need a function that will actually oversight the activities of the competition authority, right? And that will actually be done through this branch, which will be in the DTIC. One of the responsibilities, if I look at the very last bullet point, Chairperson, there, one of the responsibilities of that branch will be to actually to provide technical and administrative support to a committee that the Amendment Act says there should be a presidential committee for measures, especially where there are foreign interests in that measure. Now, that measure, it could actually have adverse effect on the national security of the country, then there is a provision there, a provision, section 18A, which would actually ask the president to actually to establish a committee. I'll speak to that later on, Chairperson. Now, in terms of the significant, when I say significant, I'm saying things that happened this year. There are three significant actions that happened this year. One, there is that Gazette, Chairperson. That is a very critical Gazette, because that is a ministerial regulation. Those regulations are in terms of some of the amended sections. The minister was actually asked to prepare those regulations in terms of that Amendment Act, and that was an extensive work, if I may say it so, Chairperson. There was also the guidelines. The guidelines were actually issued by the Competition Commission itself, and it's a detailed work that was also an extensive work that was done by the Competition Commission in this year. And they go together, the regulations and the guidelines, they go hand in hand. Right. But I would actually ask the Competition Commission who get into the details. They'll get into the details when they deal with those amended sections that I indicated earlier on. I'll skip this slide, Chairperson, because this slide is actually indicating what are the issues, that is competition issues, that were addressed by the regulation, that is that ministerial regulations, and also the guidelines that were issued by the Competition Commission. Deputy Commissioner would actually go through, right, what those guidelines actually mean in actually addressing those problems that the Commissioner was alluding to. Now, Chairperson, there's a section 18. That section 18 is the one that I mentioned. I said the section 18 is an intervention in the merger proceedings involving foreign interests. Whether the implementation of this measure is involving the foreign acquiring firms who may actually have an adverse effect on the national security. It actually expects the president to establish that committee, as I indicated, and then also that committee will be made up of the cabinet members and also some public officials that the president will actually appoint. The financial implications are such that, recall there that Chairperson, I said, we have been interacting between ourselves as the department or, and the Treasury in the determination of the funding model. Now, you will see there that in the next 3 years, we have actually indicated that to the Treasury that those allocations that are indicated there will be appropriate allocations that should actually be made available in the implementation of the Amendment Act. Now, that discussion, as we all know, Chairperson, that the budgetary process is underway, right? It will culminate into the appropriation in February of next year, right? But those figures that are indicated are the figures that at the moment they are flagging between ourselves and the Treasury as what is actually appropriate. But of course, Treasury in that engagement, he also raised the issue about the fundings that were raised by the Auditor General in 2017 of last, or of 2 years ago. Now, in there, we actually had that panel, which is actually doing the conducting the investigation on those findings of the Auditor General, and those findings, right? They are findings for the 2017. However, we actually, the Treasury actually asked that we should actually go back. 2 3 years to 2015, right? The reason is simple that Treasury in the past years, they actually saw the spikes in the spending. And then we said the team that is actually doing that investigation should actually look into those spikes as to exactly what informs them. That process is a process that is underway here, Chairperson. Now, I will not talk to the implications of the Competition Amendment Act to the tribunal, and I hope that James will actually talk to it because they are part of the sections that you are actually going to speak to. Now, Chairperson, that is the input that I really wanted to make at this point in time.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm just going to speak to some of the substance to the changes as the economist. And I'm going to go a little off script in a sense. We've provided the guidelines, which were mentioned by the DG, to the Portfolio Committee, and these were published about 10 days ago. And those are quite a substantive element to the implementation of the Act. If I can just highlight some of the amendments, there's a lot of definitional changes which help tighten up legally and provide more scope and certainty around prosecutions. But if I can highlight some of the bigger changes, I think the first one is the adjustment to the implementation of administrative penalties. So the new amendment takes away what we used to call the yellow card. So for first-time offences, much like football, you would get a yellow card and no fine. But I think the experience was that really didn't offer a deterrent effect to abuse of dominance, because firms knew even if they're caught, most they get a rap on the knuckles and move on. And fine levels in South Africa have also fallen behind the levels imposed in other jurisdictions. So in the EU, fine levels more 25% of turnover, and here they were still at 10%. So there was also a change to introduce second-time offence, a much higher fine. What that led to, though, is a request from the business community that regulations are done to provide a little more certainty then if we are going to be fined first time for an offence, that certainty should be provided. So that's where you'll see through the Amendment Act the call for regulations, and I suppose that's a more active part of the implementation plan is for the department to put together regulations. Probably the biggest other change under abuse of dominance is really around how small business and historically disadvantaged firms have been treated. So certainly our experience is that small firms, it's tough enough to make your way in a concentrated economy, but if on top of that you pay much more for your inputs and you also get much less for your products and face difficulty in accessing markets. So the Commissioner mentioned retail previously. The concentration at the sort of buyer level may mean that access to even customers is restricted. So two provisions, the so-called buyer power provisions and the price discrimination provisions, really go hand in hand to take away that disadvantage when you buy your inputs and when you sell your outputs for small business and historically disadvantaged. So those are the two big changes. And they are relatively novel because I think the experience South Africa has had is that competition law has not always served small business or those excluded from the economy particularly well. And that's because it was almost an inherited structure from other economies designed to address the worst types of abuses. But the test in competition law is typically that you must show that this action against a particular firm affects the entire market significantly. So you have this substantial lessening of competition test. But if you exclude a number of small firms, you rarely move the dial enough to get a prosecution on that basis. But I think we all know, and as economists, we would emphasize that small business are the next growing medium-sized businesses, large businesses that bring competition to an economy. There's many studies that suggest that small business also create better quality employment and more employment even in adverse times. And I think we will see currently that a lot of the focus of the economic policies to address our economic woes at the moment are centered around exactly these types of businesses. So we know that in the long run, if you nurture small business open for inclusion in the economy, that you're in a position to stimulate better growth, but also better future competition. But the competition law is not so good at looking 5 years, 10 years down the line. It's very good at looking at the here and now. So that's the big change that happens in the Amendment Act. And the test is really about harm to that category of companies, not harm to the overall market. Because we know if we protect that category of companies, we will protect competition in the overall market and stimulate growth. So those are the two big changes. But because they are also quite novel from, again, a competition law perspective, even globally, there was a request that, again, these also have regulations to guide business as to compliance, but also to provide small business with some sense of what their rights are under this new competition law. The Competition Commission also felt that guidelines would be needed. Regulations can only go so far in terms of detail, because they are issued by a minister. But as the Commission, we can offer far more detailed guidelines as to how we intend to enforce these provisions, to provide greater certainty to business, but also to provide, in some respects, a bill of rights for small business or historically disadvantaged business as to what they can expect. And why we felt that was important and is a bit of a deviation from maybe historic practice is when you're dealing with small business, a highly litigious, complex economic law is not accessible to small firms. And that was our experience, and that was part of the reason for the amendment. So what is required is maybe a slightly more novel approach, a more rules-based approach, where small firms know, in a sense, the boundaries of their rights, And in the daily negotiations with suppliers or with customers, that they can exercise those rights and say, this is what the Competition Commission has said that can't be used in terms of trading conditions imposed on us, maybe by a large retailer or the like, but also in terms of buying products, what sort of price differentials can be acceptable and which ones are not. What we also realized is if we are going to do this in a larger scale across small business, we also need to have alternative dispute resolution mechanisms in place because, again, the tribunal which hears the cases and the appeal court which hears it on appeal are lengthy, expensive processes. So within the guidelines, we've also sought to set up within what already exists within the Commission, a screening division, an ability for firms to resolve some of these disputes quickly. It doesn't necessarily result in fines and litigation, but it does mean that those businesses move on and the small businesses who are historically disadvantaged actually get an opportunity to get fair treatment. So you may call this more of a fair trading rules on both the buying and selling side. It doesn't seek to provide advantages, not that you must firms must pay better prices because it's a small firm that's supplying them, but just fair treatment. Because in any economic situation, that economic power comes into play. And as I said, our experience is that firms that sell products will just sell it at a high price to small firms because they're small customers, they don't mean much, and they can do that because the bargaining power is quite different. The same with large retailers, maybe they have an even relationship with big multinationals or local firms that supply goods. But with small suppliers, they can suddenly say, well, look, I'm only going to pay you in 90 days, not 30. And by the way, I want you to contribute to my store opening, the promotions, advertising. And those firms have little choice because this is their route to market. So that's what the guidelines have sought to do. It's, as I said, more of a novel approach. It provides quite clear rules around how we're going to approach it, which has the benefit for firms of compliance. That's something that's been a strong call, but as I said, also for small firms to know almost what their rights are in terms of that. Just quickly going into those two areas, the guidelines were issued alongside the regulations so they could be read together. There's a 30-day period for submissions. In fact, there was almost a dry run of this process last December when draft regulations were put out, but prior to the promulgation of the Act, so they had no formal status. But that process provided a lot of useful input already. So this is almost your second version of draft that's accounted for a lot of inputs already from big and small business. And we're going into further process that should have us culminating in final regulations and guidelines certainly before the end of this year. And that means that these two provisions in the Act can actually move forward and we can start to enforce them, which is important because they are the pillars really of increasing participation in the economy. Quite simply, if I can describe the buyer power and price discrimination, and I think we provided you with the background summary, which is a sort of two or three pager, which gives a flavor, because guidelines often have a slightly technical nature. As part of that innovation on guidelines, we also put things like frequently asked questions, which are a way to make it a little more accessible to a broader audience, because it shouldn't just be about law firms of large, you know, supporting large firms that can access this. It should be a broader element. But essentially, in buyer power, it's an offence for dominant buyer to impose unfair prices or trading conditions. So the approach we've largely taken on unfair prices is our experience in the economy is quite often large buyers seek to retrospectively and unilaterally impose reductions in prices. A particular feature of our retail market is what is maybe euphemistically known as margin degradation rebates, which is really when the retailer fails to meet their budget, they then retrospectively say, we want you to provide an additional rebate on your products, and it comes from the small business supplier and not the retail itself. But it's really a retailer risk, but they're imposing it on the small supplier. We've also seen in more agri-processing areas, for instance, in dairy, that the contracts with small dairy farmers have provisions for changes in prices in response to market circumstances. And that's often used to drop prices and again ensure that maybe the smaller dairy farmers impose or bear the costs of changes in the market and downturns in the market rather than the processor. So a lot of the price by an unfair pricing has not sought to introduce or look to impose a complex test of around costs and others, but more simple actions which are the worst abuses. There's also provision there for comparison of like products. So if you're supplying smaller farmers, for instance, supplying potatoes versus larger, if differences are paid for that and they're the same grade and quality, if it's just because they're a small firm and that's why they can be bullied, then we seek to change that. On the trading conditions, you'll see there's a fair list of trading conditions. And with biopower, maybe what's important to highlight is it doesn't apply to every sector in the economy. The minister in the draft regulations has to designate which sectors. And the sectors that were chosen were the food chain, so agri-processing, retail, where we know there's a lot of issues, and then what was called online intermediation services. So we know that now online platforms are an important way of accessing the market. So increasingly as the market becomes digitalized, accessing through a take-a-lot or the like to get your products to customers is important. Even some of the platforms such as Uber or Airbnb are really about suppliers and individual suppliers offering services through a platform. So in the future age, this will be important. So the kind of rules that were put up and which actually have resonance from similar processes in the European Union and elsewhere. Now, often those processes are not through the competition law. They're through more fair trading regulations. So the EU has a code of practice for the food chain. And they also have what's called platform-to-business regulations for online platforms. But those would be, for instance, in grocery. We've listed things.
Maybe to disturb you, but just mention the page you're in.
Oh,
yeah, because we're actually looking at the screen, so we have to look at the documents before. In the overall, yeah. If ever there's reference, that would be fine as well. You can proceed. Sorry to disturb.
Not at all, Chair. And if you do have the background summary, the last page of that gives a list of trading conditions as illustrative. So that isn't in the slide deck. I think we forwarded through the department the guidelines and a summary of the guidelines. So I apologize, it's not in the slide deck, but it should be in your documents around the actual guidelines themselves, if you have those.
What I would actually suggest is that we can actually, unless there's further comments you'd like to take, maybe we can actually ask you to conclude.
Sure.
And maybe we actually then can come back to the committee to actually then take clarity questions or comments. I'm sure we can proceed that way, Hermes.
Right, so
in the online mediation, because I think for me that was the most difficult part to grapple with.
All right, certainly. So on the sort of food chain, it's typical stuff around payment wastage where those are imposed on the suppliers. For online, there's a lot of cases now emerging globally where the platform themselves starts to supply in competition and favors itself in how it's ranked. So this is the Google Shopping case, for instance. So it would now start selling products in competition with other suppliers, but it would rank itself in the search much higher or give it preference. So we've got one set of rules around how you treat yourself if you're going to supply in competition, and you can't what we call self-preference. We've seen recently in South Africa much the same, that similar models, you start to enter into competition with those who use your platform. So it's about just fair trading practice there. The other area which we've included that may be of interest is really about the ranking. So in a lot of these platforms, you pay to get a better position. And the consumer behavior, as you might know as consumers, is often you'll look at the first page or the first few lines, and then you'll not be so interested. So what you see is that consumers are more likely to buy the higher ranked products. So ranking is part of monetizing a platform, and it's something we can't stop. But if it's the sole basis for ranking, or predominantly the basis for ranking, then it's unlikely a small supplier in competition with a large supplier will get a high ranking in the process. So this has a consumer protection angle. But more importantly, small firms in the online world, it's competition to get up the ranking. It's not as though you've got a series of shops in front of you and you can choose. So that is another important element. And then there are protections around data as well. I mean, maybe just to round off before handing over, probably the other big change is really in market in investigations. And market inquiries, whereas previously we had no real enforcement power, so we may conclude something is wrong, but we have no power to enforce a remedy. And the big change now is that we have that enforcement power, which means we've got, in fact, three market inquiries coming to a close over the next month, and those reports will be serving before this committee as well. We've had the health conclude, but we've got data, grocery, and public transport. But on all future inquiries, those recommendations that we come to this portfolio committee with can actually be enforced through the competition tribunal. And that is a big change, because suddenly it does empower us in a much more fundamental way to bring about changes in the market. At the moment, we either have to persuade industry to pursue it, or if it's an actual violation of the Act, then we can actually take that forward. So that's probably the two big changes, and within market inquiries, there is also a focus on participation and inclusion in the market as well. So that would be the substantive elements.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. In the interest of time, I will not go through each and every point on the state of readiness, but this slide, together with the next one, gives a synopsis of where the Commission is in terms of state of readiness to implement the various provisions of the new Act which have come into operation. I will not go, as I indicated, through each and every one of these, but this really gives a snapshot of what the Commission is currently doing in terms of implementation. The intention, as you see at the chair, at the bottom of this slide, is to submit a consolidated submission on the forms as well as the rules to the Minister, at least by the 2nd of December. So we are on track in terms of implementing the provisions of the Act, which have been gazetted, as the DG has indicated. Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, thank you very much. With such a background on the history, right, of the two Acts, and also the sections that needs to, the implementation that has happened to date, and that which is still yet to be implemented. Remember, I spoke about those interventions on the Vice Presidential establishing of a committee. Right? One, I would like us to, the committee just to note that, and then secondly, for the committee just to note that they note the regulations and the guidelines that are out now in the public for comment. We should have got those two critical issues that are important we wanted the public to comment on. And then lastly, for the committee to note the financial resources that we're actually discussing with the national treasury, and which we think that it will culminate in the appropriation in February. Thank you very much.
I'm sure what I will do is that I'll you take in just a clarification.
No, I just want to to say something about the guidelines. I realize now that it was emailed to us because I remember going through it. But I mean, we're not sitting here with our devices. So is it, just from a technical point of view, is it important that it serves the guidelines as a document serves to this committee? Because then I think we must just get a copy. But I know it was circulated electronically.
Chairperson, the regulations and the guidelines, they will serve into the in the committee. Right. At the moment, they are out to the public, and the public will comment, and then they will see the impact that it makes on what we propose, and then from there we shall then come to the WASDEM, to the committee, to say this is what was prepared or proposed, and this is what the public is actually saying, and then the committee could then reflect on that.
Okay, because I'm sure the issue of implementation, we can maybe take the members' comments, questions, McPherson, and Trin Yako, in that order.
Thank you very much. I would like to know from the Commission when they will start becoming proactive on the market dominance and abuse by state-owned enterprises on pricing in South Africa, particularly in the energy sector. So I would like to know what the Commission's stance is on that, and when and if an investigation on monopolistic behavior and anti-competitive behavior will be undertaken by them, and also with regards to South African Airways. I would like to further know if in Zaba Banzaba, attorneys is still doing work for the Commission, and I would like to know that, and what the status is of the forensic report and when that will be released, because until such time as the outcome of that report is made known, we certainly will not support any further appropriations to the Competition Commission, as the previous appropriations have been marred by fruitless, wasteful, and potentially illegal expenditure. And until such time as we have further clarity on the outcome of that report, and also the involvement or further involvement of Nzaba Banzaba attorneys, we will not support any further appropriations. So are they still doing work for you?
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I think just perhaps one comment and then one question. The first comment, Chair, is I appreciate the work that the Competition Commission does in attempting to protect the interests of the consumer. Very broad definition, protecting the interests of the consumer. Protecting the interests of the consumer in particular refers to there's a financial aspect to it, because the consumer become shortchanged in the long run. But here's the thing, Chair, and I prefaced what I'm now about to say by that. The Auditor General has found that the Competition Commission itself has received an unqualified report. and there are concerns with regards to irregular expenditure, and some of the things were raised by Honourable McPherson. And in as much as we want to hold other companies, and big companies in particular, accountable, Competition Commission needs to get its act together, particularly with regards to how it spends taxpayers' money. So I think that's the first point. My second point, which I think I've raised previously, is a concern that the ACDP has in particular, that where, for example, you have price fixing, like the bread fixing of the price of bread, for example. The ones who have been impacted by that is the consumer. The ones who have been impacted by that is the poorest of the poor. You've had increased prices in bread where it should have cost you 8 rand, you're paying 12 rand for it because somebody determined to fix the price. So the consumer is 4 rand poorer on a daily basis, depending on also how much bread you quantify, that how much bread he or she has to purchase. They have lost the money. And I do not see the consumer being compensated when big business has been punished. So I think we have to reconsider, and I know that the fines go to the fiscus and it gets lost and swallowed up in the fiscus. But it is the position of the ACDP that we have to look at compensating the poorest of the poor who continually get fleeced. And it's almost a double fleecing, because the money that should go back to them goes back into the fiscus, and who knows where that goes to. So those are my one comment and one point. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I probably should say something. This is the first time I'm engaging with the Competition Commission. I do appreciate the fact that your drive is to stimulate competition and also allow previously disadvantaged companies and small and medium-sized companies to come into the competition and also not be drowned into the space. So I do appreciate that that's your main focus. I would like to ask, what kind of resources do you outsource that are cheaper and better than you insourcing and keeping them within the structure of the Competition Commission? That is all.
Hermans, the English way. I heard the presenter speaking on the frequently asked questions. I can't remember seeing it circulated to us, because I think frequently asked questions is also assist you in understanding this complex technical document. So if it hasn't been circulated to us, if they can just do that. Also, previously, on previous legislation, there was very great interest in the CS report. Can we check whether the CS report has raised any, flagged any issues that are of concern? Because I haven't heard anything about it in the presentations. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, maybe we can take the comments, the response from the team. Floor is yours, DG and...
Chairperson, thank you very much, members, for the questions. I would ask the Commission just to deal with the first question of the Honourable McPherson, on the dominance of the SOEs, right? Deal with that. I'll deal with the financial issues, the forensic investigation issues. I would also deal with the with the spending and the price fixing, Honorable Green, right? The debate as to whether the funding is it goes to the National Revenue Fund or directly to affected citizens, right? The last question, Commissioner, you deal with it. In terms of your procurement around what are the possible opportunities that are there on the last question, if you could just deal with that. Chairperson, let me just say the issue of the forensic investigation. Right? As I indicated, it is underway. Right? It is underway. Now, I did indicate that earlier on that we are interacting between ourselves and the Treasury, right, in terms of what was done on the issues that were raised by the Auditor General. Remember that Auditor General was actually auditing the year 2017, right, when they actually picked up, they had raised concerns on the spending, the spike, now with the irregular expenditures. Now, at Treasury, how he used to fund the Competition Commission is that they actually allowed them to retain funding, right, on the interest end, on the levied penalties, right? They allowed them in the past to actually to retain that, hence I make that comment on the types of revenue streams. But then themselves, they then realized that in the past years, the spending at the commission was actually spiking, even with that cushion that is built in. They then asked that the forensic investigation, it should actually go back, right, more years than one, right? And in fact, those years they go to 2015-16. Right? Now we then ask the investigation that themselves, they instead of sampling the transactions, they should actually go and look into the full population of that data for all those years, which is what they are doing. Now this question about when it will be released. It will be released as soon as that investigation is actually completed, and which we think that before the recess, probably in December, because we're only 2 months away, and then we think that report, process, it should actually be concluded. Now, the Nzabanzaba, Honorable McPherson is asking whether Nzabanzaba is still working, right? Is still submitting the work to be in the commission. Now, that is something that I wouldn't like to actually talk about specific transactions. That particular company that the honourable member mentions is part of those that were in the past and they are part of the investigation. Right? Now that whether they are still procuring in the department, I would not know. The department could actually, the Competition Commission could talk to that, but what has happened in the past, I say, around any other company that performed work, right, if it is affected by that irregular expenditure, that is under the investigation, right? So I wouldn't want to reflect specifically on that company and say what is happening around it. Now, the part about the appropriation and financing. You know that, Honorable Green, That question is a question that we have engaged on it specifically with the Treasury, because remember that it's also a problem that we had. Remember the Tirisano funding, right? Remember the Tirisano that actually was flowing from the collusion or abuse in the construction. We did have that discussion with the Treasury, whether that funding it could be come through, right, and be utilized directly by the WASDM, by the affected people, right, instead of going into the National Revenue Fund, right. That debate, we did not win that debate. Treasury still actually insists that the funding that is actually raised through the public interest transgressions, right, then the public interest funds, those should actually go into the revenue fund. We have not won that debate. As a result, even that funding for the Tirisano, it goes to the revenue fund rather than the cry that was being made by the companies that were affected, because they wanted to handle the funding themselves and then and actually also deal directly with the beneficiaries. But we could not actually win a debate like that. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe before the Commissioner starts, Chair, I just want to just contextualize the nature of our work. Competition law, as you have seen, Chair, from the presentation that we have made, it's highly specialized and highly technical. It involves an intersection between economics and law. So those skills are quite expensive. And just to contextualize the issue, currently, senior counsel, you won't get a senior counsel in this field who charges less than 45,000 rand a day, or even a junior counsel who charges less than 20,000 a day. If we talk law firms, you will not find in this field a director at a law firm who charges less than 3,000 rand a day. Of course, as the Commission, we have made inroads in terms of insourcing the work and doing the litigation work internally. But there's still a need to outsource where we don't have a capacity ourselves.
Maybe before you proceed, I have a bit of a dilemma with time, because they're sitting at 1400 hours. The questions or comments made by members were actually captured. So what I was actually hoping to request the department to help us do is to actually maybe follow through on the questions and actually have the responses in writing, because that will actually help a great deal. And I was actually hoping that we can actually try and round up on issues in terms of actually being able to conclude our meeting. I see your hand, McPherson. I was actually just thinking that it will be important that we try and conclude our meeting. Unfortunately, I would not be able to take any further comments, questions, or discussions, because we actually have, I'm sure we have actually picked up on those. We'll ask that we actually do it in writing. So I'm just saying it's if I can actually just overrule the committee and be able to actually then help us proceed just to the conclusion part, DG, because I think it will be quite important that we actually do conclusion. Unfortunately, honourable members, I won't be able to actually proceed further. So if we can allow...
Chair, I do want to register my strong objection. I asked a very yes or no question as to whether Indaba and Zaba attorneys are doing work, and all they had to do was say yes or no. We can't delay these things when they are important.
This is the thing I'm trying to avoid, so that we don't end up walking in the corridor arguing with each other. I think decently we can be able to conclude, and I'm sure the questions were there. I'm sure the other members would like to have follow-up questions as well, DG. So I'll just say that can we then agree on what I suggest, and let's see how we actually follow through, and maybe ask you to give us your closing comments, because that's quite important.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Let me just acknowledge the suggestion that is actually made. Right, we have been writing down the questions that we asked. We shall actually make them available, those that have been asked. Right, and then we could then make a call whether they have covered the points specifically. Right. Now, Chairperson, as I indicated, I said there are three points that are really important for the committee to note. Is to note the progress that has been made in the implementation of the Amendment Act since the promulgation in July. Note those regulations and guidelines, and because it's important that as members actually engage with the public, they should actually to urge them and encourage them to actually to comment on the WASNIMs, because those competition two important two competition issues are very critical. That will be closing in a month's time, right? Somewhere in November, those regulations will actually be closing. And also note that those that are still yet to be implemented, I indicated which ones were still yet to be implemented. For instance, that presidential committee which is yet to be established. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
DG, we'll try maybe by the end of next week to ask that we get the response on the questions. And maybe we can, tomorrow for honourable members, we do actually have a sitting starting at 9:30 to one at the committee room 3, 9:30 in the morning training. It's actually the induction part. I'm sure it's circulated on the programme. We'll see you in the morning, tomorrow morning. Thank you very much, DG, and the team. Come again? 90 Plain Street. 90 Plain Street. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.